offering my most loving pranams at Bhagwan's lotus feet. Dear listeners, I welcome you to this week's episode of the Gita series. A very warm good morning to all of you from Prashanthi Nilayam. Even as I say warm good morning, it's been raining here since last night. But nevertheless, it's a pleasant weather that is greeting all of us this morning. And it is my pleasure, as always, to join you live from our studios at Prashanthi Nilayam. We are in the last part of the 8th chapter. Those of you who have been following us regularly, we go through the Bhagavad Gita series verse by verse in parallelly going through the Gita Vahini written by Swami. That's what we try and do, and we also use the many other discourses where Swami has spoken about various of these topics as the backdrop of going through the Gita. We are in the last part of the 8th chapter, and all things going as planned, we should be able to complete all the verses of the 8th chapter next week. And of course, as always, we'll take up a summary the week thereafter. To give you a short summary of what we covered last time and to set the context for what we're going to go through today, we covered three verses last time, the verse number 20, 21 and 22. But before we came to this part, Krishna was speaking of how all of creation manifests from Brahma and goes back to the unmanifest state at the end of Brahma's day. And we spoke of how the waking and the sleep of Brahma is correlated to the creation coming into manifestation and then going back into the state of unmanifest. And this sleep or deep sleep of Brahma was what was being referred to as avyakta, the unmanifest state. In the 20th verse, Krishna clarifies that this avyakta which is being referred here is not the supreme avyakta which is often spoken of in Vedanta. He says, paraha tasmatu bhavaha anyaha avyaktaha avyaktat sanatanaha. But distinct from the unmanifested that was being spoken of so far is another unmanifest which is eternal, which is sanatanaha. And then he goes on to say, yaha sa sarveshu bhuteshu nashyatsu na vinashyati. And this one doesn't get destroyed even when all of creation is dissolved at the end of time. In the 21st verse, Krishna says that this avyakta which he spoke of in the previous verse, which is called akshara, or immutable, tam ahuhu paramam gatim, that is also described as the ultimate state, paramam gatim. And he further says that this is the state which when attained, there is no return. And that tad dhamam paramam mama, that's how he concludes that 21st verse. He says, tad dhamma paramam mama. That state is my state. We then spoke of the various implications of this word gati, a multi-layered, multi-meaning word from Sanskrit. How this word, with its multiple meanings, also tends to describe the multifaceted nature of the spiritual journey itself. That was a short discussion that we had last week. In the 22nd verse, Krishna says how this supreme Purusha is attainable through one-pointed devotion. And we had spoken of this, how it connects what Krishna has been telling about think of me when your thoughts are of me, when you give up this body, you reach me. This is a way by which it is all connected together, because in this verse, the 22nd verse, he says Purushaha sa paraha partha bhaktya labhyastva anyaya. This supreme Purusha, this supreme being is attainable through bhakti, and he qualifies that bhakti by saying bhaktyastva ananyaya. The ananya bhakti, one-pointed bhakti, is capable of taking you to that supreme being. He then concludes that 22nd verse with a very crisp and beautiful one-line definition of this Purusha that he was speaking of. And he says, yasya antasthani bhutani within whom all beings exist, yena sarvam idam tatam, by whom all this is pervaded. Yasya antasthani bhutani, within whom all beings exist, yena sarvam idam tatam. And he also pervades all that there is. A very beautiful way of describing that supreme being. We then went on to have a short discussion on how this part of the Bhagavad Gita, especially this verse, is a reference to a very important portion from the Kathopanishad, where the various implements or instruments of the spiritual journey is spoken of and how each one is superior to the other. And eventually it comes to this Purusha, who is spoken of as being more supreme than the Avyakta. And this portion of the Gita is a reference to that very profound portion from the Kathopanishad. So the general theme of discussion in these past few shlokas has been the journey of no return, right? If I could put it that way. Because we are speaking of two journeys. One journey, there is a return, you come back into this cycle. There is another journey, if one embarks on, there is no return to this cycle. In that context, we spoke of the other lokas, the durations, time dilation, the creation cycle, how life on earth itself is a relentless cycle. Krishna also spoke of how one has to leave the body at the time of leaving, how it has to be done. The simplest of all those descriptions is, when you think of me, you reach me, right? That's the simplest thing that he said. But another important point that he said, the very following shloka is, he said, in the sixth shloka of this chapter, he said, yam yam vapi smaran bhavam tyajatyante kalevaram tam tam yeva eti kaunteya sada tadbhava bhavitaha. O Arjuna, thinking of any entity, whichever it may be, when you give up the body at the end, the person attains that very object that he was thinking of, that very deity that he was thinking of, that very loka that he was thinking of. You can put whatever you're thinking of at this point. Whatever one is thinking of, having been always engrossed in that thought, that is where that person reaches. That is what that person attains. So on one hand, he says, think of me in the last moments you reach me. Or think of whatever you're thinking, whatever you're engrossed with, whatever you've filled your life with. Be sure that that will be your last thought when you bid farewell to this world. And that will be your state, or that will decide your journey, as it were. Then, of course, we spoke of the various other details about the prana, the chanting of pranava, the breath being stabilized in a certain way and so on. So all of this is a description of the various physical indications of the person whose journey is going to be towards that state of no return, or ways by which you can embark on that journey. So these are all descriptions which are all surrounding, or which are all, you know, based on that idea of the journey of no return. In this next portion, Krishna is going to speak of another important aspect, or another way by which you can recognize this Mahatma, right? That's the title that he had given, a Mahatma who is going to embark on this journey. There is another way you can recognize such a person. But he's going to do it more so as a contrast with a normal person who is embarking on the journey of return versus the person who is embarking on that journey of no return. The Anavritam is what he is going to call it. So this will be the theme for the rest of the shlokas of this chapter, and this is how the chapter itself is going to conclude. So we will go to the next verse. We will go to the 23rd verse. From there, Krishna starts speaking of another very important aspect of recognizing this person. And as we have always seen, none of these shlokas are devoid of deep inner significance, and one has to even dwell on those. And fortunately for us, Swami is here to guide us into that subtle understanding of the shlokas. But for that, first we'll listen to the shloka. I'll give you a brief meaning of that. Then we'll discuss in detail what Krishna is conveying through these shlokas.
Yatra kale tvana vrittim ఆవృత్తిం చైవ యోగినః ప్రయాతాయాంతి తం కాలం వక్ష్యామి భరతర్షభ.
The best of the Bharata dynasty, I shall now speak of that time by departing at which the yogis attained the state of non-return, and also of the time by departing at which they attained the state of return. So that's the 23rd verse, and there you can see Krishna is laying out what he is going to speak about. He is going to speak about the time of the day, the time of the month, and the time of the year when it is best to leave the body. And even as I say that, this cannot be taken literally, because this is not an instruction that is meant to be practiced, right? When Krishna speaks of karma yoga, when he speaks about karma phala tyaga, when he speaks about equanimity, when he speaks about doing one's duty, all of those are practical instructions that need to be heard and practiced. But when Krishna says, I'm going to tell you the time at which you can die, this is not meant for practice. There is an inner significance to it. And also, it can also be seen as a way by which you can recognize a noble life, right? That is a very important thing. Unless, as we will see, if any of you have the boon of Ichha Mrityu, the ability to choose the moment of death, not in the sense of taking one's own life. We had a discussion of that a couple of weeks back. This is not like that. But if you have the boon or the noble ability of Ichchamrityu, death by choice, like the great Bhishmacharya, then maybe this sloka applies to you as it is. But pretty much we can say that this is not for practice. This is not so that we can plan to die at a certain time or during a certain part of the year. Krishna says in the shloka, he says, yatra kale, in which time, tu, verily, yoginah prayataha, when yogis depart, yanti, they go to anavrittim, avrittim cha eva, the state of no return, and even the state of return, tam kalam vakshyami, I will tell, or I will speak about that time, Bharata Rishabha, O chief or best among Bharatas. Krishna says, I will tell about the time, kale, he says, yatra kale. I am going to tell about the time during which a person who is embarking on the journey of no return, anavrittim, what time such a person departs, and the person who is taking the journey of return, avrittim, what time that person departs. I'm going to speak about or explain about both these, Krishna says in this shloka. In the following shlokas, Krishna is going to give the details. But before we go into all those details, there are a few interesting observations we can make here. Firstly, when Krishna said, all you have to do is think of me during the last moments, we did discuss how there are no cheat codes in this. But still, when you look only at the statement, it appears that it is so simple. You know, do whatever you want to do with your life, but ensure that towards the end you turn to God, you start thinking of God, and that's it. You will go into the sunset thinking of God. It seems so simple. When Krishna says that there is a specific time when such a Mahatma departs the world, it is to stress on the point that this passing away or this discarding of the physical body is not a random event, right? It might appear like it's a random event. It might appear like it depends on so many other factors around. There is a pandemic going on and, you know, I was not supposed to die. Suddenly something is happening. Things happen very randomly or so it appears. But there is a precision to all this. And I think that is a hint that Krishna is giving by saying, I will tell you what exactly is the time when such a person will die. Another belief relating to the time or a day on a noble day on which dying is very considered very sacred, There are some of these traditions in Bharatiya culture. One such day is the Vaikuntha Ekadashi, right? They say that death during the Vaikuntha Ekadashi is considered as a gateway to Vaikuntha itself. So it's considered very auspicious if one were to discard the physical body on this day. I recall the passing away of a very noble devotee on such a Vaikuntha Ekadashi day, and interestingly, that year when he passed away, the Vaikuntha Ekadashi fell on 7th Jan, exactly on this day, maybe about 13-14 years ago. The person I'm talking about is Mr. Habu. Many of our students, if any of you are listening to this program, know him pretty well. Habu sir, as he was fondly called, was the principal of the high secondary school in Prashanthi Nilayam, and I think for 9 years or something he served. He was pretty much instrumental in setting up the school and the systems as they are being practiced even till today. And today, if we see the school excelling in academics and all other curricular activities, he has a big role to have played, the you know, laying the foundation for that entire system. And before that, he was a lecturer of the erstwhile Sri Satyasai Arts and Science College in Vrindavan for I think a decade. And even after his retirement, he would teach history in college, and that's how some of us had our interaction with him. He was a great patriot, a Gandhian, a brilliant teacher, a strict disciplinarian, and above all, a very great devotee of Swami, who was such a great inspiration, continues to be such a great inspiration to all of our students. Swami would, in fact, very fondly say, Habbu is Kabbu. Swami would say, Kabbu in Kannada means sugarcane. That's how fondly Swami would speak of him. The event I'm referring to was his passing away, and it happened, as I said, about 13-14 years ago. He was keeping unwell. He was well past his 80. He was hospitalized in a super specialty hospital, and it looked like it was his last few days. And if I'm not wrong, he was in the hospital for a couple of weeks. And that year, the Vaikuntha Ekadashi was on the 7th of January. And a couple of days before, his health started showing improvement. And, you know, some of us were thinking that, you know, it's a Vaikuntha Ekadashi coming, and maybe Swami will choose to take him on that particular day. It's a perfect sign of a noble life that he has led. And 2 days before that Vaikuntha Ekadashi day, as things would be, he started showing improvement. His health started improving, and then it looked like maybe Swami has other plans. But very miraculously, you know, you can use miraculously even for death when you're in Swami's fold. On that morning, Vaikuntha Ekadashi morning, suddenly his health very quickly deteriorated, and right on that day, he passed away. We may be thinking that so-and-so is in the hospital, the doctors are responsible for their life, or some medication did not go the right way, or this organ failed and so he passed away. It may appear that so many of these factors are involved, but it is clearly not so. These are all things that very, very mysteriously and precisely fall in place in the case of such people. And I remember a very beautiful discourse that Swami delivered on his birthday in the year 2003, where Swami fondly recollected many old-time devotees and spoke of how each of them passed away. Swami spoke about Subhamma, Swami spoke about Sri Seshagiri Rao, Sri Kamavadani, Mr. Gopal Rao, Professor Kasturi, Pujari, Kishtappa. Swami spoke of all these people and how very peacefully they passed away, and how that passing away was a sign of the noble life that they had lived. And being here in Prashanthi Nilayam, I can tell you listeners that we've been a witness to many such glorious farewells, because many great devotees whom we have seen moving on have moved on in such admirable ways. Talking about Seshagiri Rao, his passing away was quite interesting. The episode actually shows us how when you submit yourself to Swami, he not only takes care of your life, but also chooses your departure or the way you depart. And in that case, even suffering is nothing but a blessing in disguise. I know this is a detour from the Gita Shlokas that we are going through, but I request you to indulge me for a few minutes. The reason is because when we live with the avatar, some of these philosophies and theories, they are being lived before our eyes in a manner that we can see directly, pratyaksham, as we've been using that word. It happens right in front of you. You read it in the Bhagavad Gita, you read it in the scriptures, you think, oh, okay, so somebody must be going through that. And when you're living with God incarnate, you see some of these theories being played out in front of you. So when we say death is in the hands of God, when we say Swami will become the driver of our lives and He will maneuver our lives to the destination, these are all real life incidents that stand as testimony to that grace, to that promise that God gives. So, and that is why I wanted to speak a little bit about this before we carry on with our Bhagavad Gita. Professor Kasturi, whose passing away is also a very beautiful story in itself, maybe for some other day, he writes about Seshagiri Rao's passing away in Satyam Shivam Sundaram, part 2. He says there, you know, before he starts narrating this episode, he writes there, in the Viveka Chudamani, Shankaracharya refers to the master as Ahetuka Daya Sindhu, the ocean of mercy that saves without any reason or context. Baba is like that. He cures some chronic illness by the exercise of his sankalpa, his will. He allows others to suffer, and no one can say why. So this is the prelude to that episode of Seshagiri Rao's passing away. And he says, some people Swami allows them to suffer, some people Swami cures them. You cannot say how or why that is so. You can only be sure that both cases are cases of His grace. And then he goes on to describe Sri Seshagiri Rao's passing away. And as most of you might know, Seshagiri Rao Garu was the first pujari of Swami's mandir, what we now refer to as Pata Mandir. He came to Swami very early in the mid-1940s. After serving Swami for close to 14 years, it looked like his time had come. He had a fall, and after that he fell very sick, and it looked like he was very quickly, his health was deteriorating. So Professor Kasturi goes to visit him, and he is absolutely stunned to see Seshagiri Rao lying on the bed and chanting verses from the Vedas that declare the truth of one's true self. And he says only great sages probably can recall such profound verses at the time of death, because he was lying there, Seshagiri Rao was declaring loudly in chaste Sanskrit. He was saying, this body is composed of the five elements, it is disintegrating into its components, and I am being liberated. Seeing this scene, Professor Kasturi thinks, what a great death to recall such profound truths in the last few moments. And he thinks, now this is going to be a very historical moment. And even as he was standing there, Swami comes there after being informed about Mr. Seshagiri Rao's health deteriorating very quickly. And seeing Swami, Kasturi thinks, wow, this is going to be a real grand farewell now. Even Swami has come. But then he says what he witnesses is nothing short of an anticlimax. Swami comes to Sri Seshagiri Rao and starts reprimanding this old devotee who is lying on the bed. He says, how dare you start on this journey without taking a ticket from me? Mark those words. What beautiful and what powerful words. He says, how dare you start on this journey without taking a ticket from me? Swami continues, come down and do the work allotted to you. I order you, come to the prayer hall this very noon and carry on with the aarti as usual. These were Swami's words. Professor Kasturi writes, we were all aghast at this unkindness. Imagine that poor devotee is lying on the bed and he's not able to go. I mean, he thinks that his last moments have come, his health is failing him, his energies are ebbing out, and Swami comes and speaks like this. But then, being the great devotee that he is, he accepted Swami's orders, he followed them. Seshagiri Rao comes down, does the aarti as Swami had asked him to do, and then continues with his duties, and then he became quite all right. And he continues with his duties as the pujari for the next 6 months. And then he falls sick again. Okay, and this time when he falls sick, he is admitted in the general hospital, and this time he is not recalling some Vedic mantras or Upanishads. He is in a very, very pathetic state. He starts losing his mind. He doesn't distinguish between dirt and cleanliness. And whoever comes and sees him, they felt so very bad for him. You know, somebody who has served Swami for so many years, should he be suffering like this in his last moments? And the contrast was so obvious. You know, he had a very beautiful farewell, it looked like, which was just there for the taking, and Swami came and took him away from the, you know, the last moments, such glorious last moments, and now he is suffering like this, and looks like this is how he is going to end his earthly sojourn. Sri Seshagiri Rao's children come to Swami and they ask Swami, Swami, can we take him to Bangalore? And apparently there was a hospital in Bangalore where many of Seshagiri Rao's family were working. So the children said, we'll take him there. We would like to serve him. We would like to take good care of him. And in reply, Swami said, no, I will not permit you to take him. Swami then explained, see, I could have sent him off 6 months ago only when he fell sick. But then he had little karma left, and I am letting him finish all that under my supervision. And Swami said, after that, be sure that he will leave peacefully. And as Swami promised, after about a month suffering like this, his health again mysteriously improved. He became very active, and for 6 weeks after that, he performed all his duties normally. And then, after 6 weeks, he again fell sick. This time, when he was lying on his bed, Swami goes to see him, and Professor Kasturi writes that he had the opportunity to be with Swami in that visit. Swami goes to Sri Seshagiri Rao's bed. Swami asks for a glass of hot milk, and then Swami feeds this great devotee that milk spoon by spoon, spoon by spoon, calling him by name and telling him, see, it is your Swami who's here. It is your Swami who's giving you this milk. And so lovingly Swami fed him that glass of milk. After feeding him, Swami gets up. Swami walks towards the door. And just before leaving, Swami turns and says, now you can go. And then walks away. And within an hour, this great devotee peacefully passed away. And Professor Kasturi brilliantly concludes this episode by writing wonderful words, and I should quote this here. Professor Kasturi writes, Baba knew when he had to come down and when he had to go. We can only watch and pray, only stand aghast at the wonder and meaningful waywardness of the wind of grace. End of quote. How beautiful it is. We can only watch and pray, only stand aghast at the wonder and meaningful waywardness of the wind of grace. It cannot be put better, isn't it? Really, how fortunate we are to be able to witness grace like this. I think these episodes are not for us to just listen and marvel about and, oh, what a great episode, what a great experience. These are for us to listen and bolster our own faith. Krishna had said, Purushah sa paraha partha bhaktya labhyah tu ananyaya. That supreme being is attainable through one-pointed devotion. These episodes are reminders of this promise that Krishna gave, this promise that Swami gives each one of us. The more we listen to these kind of stories, the more enthused we must become, the more committed we should become in our path of devotion, in our path of sadhana, right? So coming back to our Gita, I've not completely forgotten that. Certainly death and the moment of death is not something that occurs randomly. So even literally, the time of the year, the time of the month of passing away, all of these has significance. But apart from that, there is also a subtle inner meaning to all this. And that inner meaning is connected to what Krishna spoke about right in the beginning of the chapter itself. So we will discuss that also after going through the next shloka, where Krishna starts describing that path of no return. But before that, just one more point. Here Krishna refers to both as yogis, those that transcend life and death, and those that follow the spiritual path. Those that transcend life and death and those that come back and get caught in life and death. Both of these are being described by Krishna as yogis in this portion, in this shloka. So one way of looking at it is, Krishna is not even speaking of those whom Swami referred to as karma bhrashtas, who do deplorable actions of harming others and cheating others and so on. As Swami had said, these people start creating their future births even as they perform these wrong acts. In some rare cases, they are even born into animal forms, right? We will again speak about it a little after the next shloka. Here Krishna is speaking about those that have a certain sense of morality, who fall under sakama karma and karma phalatyaga. If you recall those four categories, we will allude to that shortly after the shloka also. So those that Krishna spoke earlier in a previous chapter as yoga bhrashtas, those who take to the spiritual path and probably don't attain perfection on the path, even they are referred to as yogis. So Krishna is covering all these people under the term yoginaha, where he speaks of here. And as many commentators observe, Krishna also excludes a few people in this description. And who are those for whom there is no journey hereafter? We will speak about them also in our description. But for that, first we will listen to the next shloka, where Krishna speaks about the journey of anavrittim, the journey of no return. This is the 24th shloka. We'll listen to it. I'll give you a brief meaning of that, and then we'll discuss in detail.
Agnir jyotirah shuklah shanmasa uttarayanam tatra prayata gacchanti brahma brahma vidojana.
Fire, light, daytime, the bright fortnight, the 6 months of the northern solstice. By following this path, persons who are knowers of Brahman attain Brahman when they die. So that's the 24th verse. First, Krishna speaks about those yogis that have lived a spiritual life and are ready to journey towards Brahman, or Brahmaloka, to be more precise. We will come to how that is different also. So before I start speaking about this portion of the Gita, let me confess that I'm going to be sharing things that I've been able to make out from the various references that I've gone through for this particular portion. If there are any mistakes in my explanation, those who are more knowledgeable can feel free to correct me. But for now, I have the mic, so you will have to listen to me, you will have to indulge me. I will try to share my understanding based on the various commentaries and descriptions that I've read. Also, I've tried to go through some of Swami's other vahinis too. I'm not giving reference to each one of those vahinis, because there are no specific things that I've picked out from there. Just to get a complete idea of what Krishna is speaking about here, I went through. So I'll just present as I understand. If anything is amiss, please forgive me and feel free to point that out. According to the scriptures, there are three pathways after death that the jiva can take. They are Devayana, the path of gods; Pitrayana, I think that's how it is pronounced. Devayana and Pitrayana, the path of the Pitrus or ancestors; and the pathway of sinners, which is sometimes called Adhoyana. The pathway of sinners is not discussed much in this part of the Gita. I think much later Krishna does make references to it, what happens to those who fall in this path. The first two, Devayana and Pitrayana, are discussed in this portion. These two paths are also referred to as Uttarayana, the northward journey, and Dakshinayana, the southward journey. In this shloka, Krishna speaks of the first path, which is called Devayana and Uttarayana. There is another name too, we will come to that, because it is based on what Krishna is saying in the shloka. Now, just to set a context to all of this, let us go back to those four categories of people that Swami spoke about. The lowest are karma bhrashtas. They are the ones who take the third pathway, which leads to hell, right? Maybe even lower birth, maybe as an animal, as a being lower than a human birth, or to lower lokas. The second last that Swami spoke about are those that perform sakama karma. In the more traditional sense, these are people who perform acts prescribed in the scriptures, like ritualistic fire sacrifices, yajnas, yagas, other ritualistic worships, rituals connected to various events in lives, at the time of birth, at the time of upanayanam, and marriage, and death, and all of those things are very religiously and rigorously followed. These are sometimes referred to as sakama karma. In a more general sense, people who lead moral lives, do not harm or cheat others, but whatever they do, be it rituals, worship, or good actions, there is a view of enjoying the benefits of their actions. Either they want a good name in society, they want people to be good to them in return, or people who think that I am being good now, I'll be blessed with heaven later. So in whatever way you have set yourself a desire for the good acts that you're performing, you fall under this category of sakama karma, right? So in a more general sense, all people who lead moral lives, who do not harm or cheat others, but yet work with an eye on the benefits, these are referred to as sakama karma. These people take to the path which is referred to as Pitrayana. And the category that Swami described as Nishkama Karma, the Karma Yogis, they embark on Devayana. The best category that Swami described is not addressed in these shlokas, those that are described as Karma Titas. Right? If you're wondering, if some of you have not heard the previous episodes and you're wondering what are these categories, in the Gita Vahini, in the 17th chapter, if I'm not wrong, Swami speaks about four categories of people based on the kind of karmas they perform. And they are, the first category is Karma Tita, second category is Nishkama Karma, third one is Sakama Karma, and the fourth one is Karma Bhrashtas. And I'm trying to connect those four categories to these various pathways. So there are three pathways, the worst pathway, the pathway to hell, if you want to call it, that is connected to the Karma Bhrashtas. The Sakama Karma category is connected to the Pitrayana. The Nishkama Karma is connected to the Devayana or the Uttarayana. And the best category, Karma Titas, is what we are talking about. Swami says that they are untouched by any karma. And when there is no karma, there is no consequence of actions performed, there is no journey to undertake thereafter. And such a person is referred to as a Jivan Mukta, one who is liberated even while alive. When the doership is completely sublimated, no acts performed will be attached to consequences, and even if there are consequences, there is no ego for those consequences to get attached. We have spoken about all of this when we were talking about Karma Yoga. So Swami explains the journey of such a person, this portion in the Jnana Vahini, right? He doesn't of course say that this is about this particular part of the Gita, but based on the readings, I can say this. Swami explains the journey of this such a person in Jnanavahini, and he says, the mind is the obstacle that has to be overcome so that one can identify one's true self, who can identify one's true identity with the Supreme Brahman. And this destruction of the mind happens in two stages. Swami says, destruction of form, rupalaya, and destruction of the formless aspect of the mind, arupalaya. So these are the two stages in which the mind is being sublimated. Rupalaya, the form aspect of the mind, the arupalaya, the formless aspect of the mind. What is this rupalaya? Swami says, the way the mind troubles is by creating forms, right? Like the mirage, like seeing a snake where there is a rope. The world is unreal, but you see it as real. So these are all born out of this ability of the mind to project things that are actually non-existent. So in the first stage, in Rupalaya, all such forms which are projections have to be dismissed. So when there is a mirage, right, the classic example that we always go back to, there is a mirage, you think there is water, but when you are wise, the mirage is still there, but you know that there is no water there, right? You see it as it is. The mirage continues to exist in front of you, but you do not associate the mirage with real water. In the same manner, a jnani sees the world. The world is still present before the jnani. The world is still present before this person whom we refer to as a mukta, even while alive. He performs actions also, but he is not for one moment deluded by what is in front of him. He sees the mirage, but does not get fooled by the mirage. He sees the world, but does not get fooled into thinking that the world is real. And when this state is attained, where you have reached a state where you are able to dismiss all these forms that the mind creates, Swami says, this understanding or this enlightenment expresses itself as a state of bliss and equilibrium. And Swami says, this is what is referred to as Jivan Mukti. You're still alive, the world is still in front of you, but your mind does not give credence to any of this. Right? That is what is referred to as Jivan Mukti. Then Swami says the next stage is the Arupalaya, where the mind itself is destroyed. In the first stage, you only destroy the projections of the mind. In the next stage, the mind itself is destroyed. It is said that the mind remains till the prarabdha is exhausted. And at the time that the body is discarded, the state of videha mukti, or liberation after giving up the body, is attained. So there is no journey for such a soul, right? When there is jivan mukti, when there is liberation and knowledge when alive, when the body is discarded, the soul very spontaneously gives up even that, the subtle aspect of the mind, and merges in Brahman instantly, right? So there is no journey in this case. And that is why Swami had referred in the Gita Vahini, and I made a reference to that a couple of weeks back. Swami says there are two types of mukti, sadhya mukti and karma mukti, right? The sadhya mukti is also referred to as kaivalya. And the jivan muktar attains this instantly. There is no journey for that person. What Krishna describes here as the two types of journeys that we're going to speak of in this shloka and the next one, I believe, is karma mukti, or gradual liberation. If I have to explain this in very, very simplistic terms, and I'm sure it is not as simple as this, I'm just trying to put it in a way that we can make a sense of it. It is like earning a doctorate. If you're a scientific prodigy, let's say, and you come up with some brilliant discovery or an invention, a university might come forward and confer a doctorate on you. Right? You've contributed immensely to science. So they confer a doctorate on you. And sometimes you've seen this very young people who have, you know, who have not gone through the regular course of education, but still getting conferred doctorate as a recognition of their intelligence. But there is also a specific way by which you can eventually get a doctorate. There is a specific coursework, probably there's an interview, you have to do research work, and then you'll have to write a thesis, you have to submit it to a panel, and then you'll have to attend a viva, and then at the end of it, you get the same doctor title, right? Though it's a conferred doctor and it's an earned doctorate, you still will have the same DR in front of your name, isn't it? So these two journeys is the same thing is attained, one instantly and the other by following a set procedure. The latter is like karma mukti or gradual liberation, and the former is sadhya mukti or kaivalya, where there is no journey, right? You've already deserved that title even while alive. Let's see what Krishna says and if we can make sense of it. Krishna says, Agnihi, fire, Jyotihi, light, Ahaha, day, Shuklaha, the bright fortnight, Shanmasa Uttarayanam, the 6 months when the sun travels northward, Tatra, there, Janaha, the people, Brahma Vidaha, knowers of Brahman, or those that meditate upon Brahman, Prayataha Gacchanti, the departed go, Brahma, to Brahman. Those that have pursued Brahman, or the spiritual goal, reach Brahman, following the path of fire, light, day, the bright fortnight, or the waxing phase of the moon, the Uttarayana, and so on. Well, before we make sense of this, this again is a very concise reference to what is spoken of in many Upanishads as the journey of the soul towards the ultimate mukti. There are much, much more elaborate descriptions of what Krishna is saying here in just one sentence. So by putting all of this in one sentence, Krishna is in a way giving validity to some of these Upanishads, right? That's what we've seen through the Bhagavad Gita. There is one thing that Krishna is constantly doing. There are 5 aspects that Krishna mentioned in that shloka. And of these, 3 are references to some form or aspect of time. And in the previous shloka, Krishna had said, Yatra Kale, during which time? And that is being referred to here. And Swami also says that these 3 are direct references to times during which one gives up the body. And what are those times that he referred to? He says, Ahuhu, during the day, Shuklaha, during the bright fortnight, Shanvasa Uttarayanam, during the 6 months when the sun is moving northward. Swami says in the Gita Vaini that these are direct references to time also. You can make that out from the statement that Swami is making. Swami says, the yogis who practice action without desire for the fruit, Nishkama karma, pass away in splendor or tejas during the day while there is light, in the bright half of the month, and in the 6 month period of the northward path of the sun, what is referred to as Uttarayana. So as I said, here it is all reference to time, daytime, bright fortnight, and so on and so forth. Another way of looking at it is each of these natural phenomena are ruled by certain deities. There is a deity for day, there is a deity for Shukla Paksha, there is a deity for Uttarayana, and each of these deities govern a level or plane of existence that is higher than the previous one. And this Devayana, or the path towards path of no return, is an upward journey that passes through all these different levels, which are being governed by different deities. When Krishna had said Yatra Kale, Kale means time, but Kale is also sometimes seen as a reference to a god or a devata, right? Kala also is used in some sense to represent a devata. That's what I believe. In fact, even Adi Shankara in his commentary, that's what he suggests. So that's why Swami says in Gita Vahini, just after that statement that I read out, where Swami said, if you die in the morning, if you die during the Shukla Paksha, if you die during the Uttarayana, you reach or you take to the Devayana. Just after Swami made that statement, Swami goes on to explain that the first level is the level of Agni. And since Agni is a Devata, that is why the path is called Devayana. Agni has another name in the Vedas, Swami says, Archi. And so it is also called Archiradi Marga. So this path has got three names now. It is called Uttarayana, it is called Devayana, it is also called Archiradi Marga. Swami goes on to say, such yogis emerge from effulgence, and traveling through effulgence, merge in effulgence itself. They attain Brahman and are not born again. That is why the reference to all aspects of nature that represent brightness, right? In the shloka, all the five elements that Krishna speaks about have a relationship with brightness. Agni, Jyoti, Day, the waxing phase of the moon, and the Uttarayana. All of those represent brightness. What is the validity of seeing these names that Krishna is saying as devatas, instead of taking the literal meaning as day and night and all of that? If you recall, the chapter started with Arjuna asking about Adhi Yajna and Adhi Daiva. Right? That's how this entire 8th chapter begins. And we had discussed at that point this concept of Adhi Daiva. Just as I have an Atma, which is my true self, and that is referred to as Adhi Atma, every natural phenomenon is spoken of as being governed by a deity. And that deity aspect of all these natural phenomenon is referred to as Adhi Daiva. And Krishna had clearly stated, Purushaha Adhi Daivatam. Purushaha Adhi Daivatam. The true Adhi Daiva is the Lord himself, is the Purusha himself. When we speak of Brahmavid here, those who have learnt or those who have understood or recognized Brahman, what is it that they have recognized? They have recognized that the Brahman, the Lord, is the true self in oneself and in all beings. So the jnani is one who has come to recognize the Supreme Purusha as the only deity behind all deities. Right? That's how this entire chapter begins. So such a person has not aspired the grace or the blessings of any other deity. So he or she does not get stuck in these various levels, which are spoken of as being governed by these various deities. Because if you had worshipped Agni with a certain desire of gaining something, then you have not seen the Purusha behind Agni. The true Adi Daiva behind this fire is not the Agni Deva, but the Lord himself. So you get stuck in a lower level where you have worshipped this deity. If you recall, that was again a reference that Krishna had made in an earlier chapter. If you worship these deities, it is to the deities that you go. So when you're talking about a Brahmavid, the one who has recognized Brahman, he is somebody who has recognized that the Lord alone is the one who is behind all this. So he goes through these various lokas, governed by these various deities, without being distracted or drawn to any of them. The mind stays focused on the Lord, passes through all these levels undistracted and reaching the state of no return. And this is what Krishna has said in the 16th verse itself. He had said, Abrahma bhuvana lokaha punaravrittim na Arjuna. The end of this journey, according to the scriptures, is Brahmaloka, right? When the Upanishads speak of this journey, it says that you are trying to reach that Brahmaloka. But in that shloka, Krishna had said, right up to the Brahmaloka, staying put in any of the lokas in between is subject to return. Even after reaching Brahmaloka, you may get stuck there. But when the mind is fixed on the Lord and Lord alone, then the person attains Brahman and are not born again. So this path is referred to as Devayana, Uttarayana and also Archiradi Marga. But all this is also symbolic. It also has a subtle meaning and that must not be overlooked. After having spoken of as this literally meaning times during the day, month and year, after having given that hint that there's something more to it, in that same chapter, the 17th chapter of Gita Vaini, Swami goes on to explain, and Swami says, I quote, now you must first understand what is meant by the bright fortnight, Shukla Paksha. It is the half month when the light of the moon increases day by day. But what is the relationship of the light of the moon to a person and their death? The moon is the symbol of the mind of people. Therefore, the bright half of the moon signifies the progress of the mind spiritually in divine discipline, and the full moon signifies the fullness of that achievement. Thus, the bright half is the period when spiritual progress is attained. For the body, the visible moon, for the mind, the symbolic moon, the moon deity presiding over the mind. The increasing splendor of the moon due to the increasing realization of one's own divinity is what is meant by the word bright half or Shukla Paksha. End of quote. Swami clearly states, you must be an aspirant who is on the path of spiritual progress, and then your mind is marching towards that full wisdom. So when we say death can come at any time, whenever death catches up, we must ensure that we are in that Shukla Paksha. I think we all go through that back and forth in the spiritual journey, right? Just like how the moon waxes and wanes, we also have those periods of lull and periods of spiritual exuberance. But as we progress on the spiritual journey, with effort, we reduce these fluctuations and move towards a state where our life is defined by our sadhana, right? Right now we are 3 months in spiritual full josh, as we say. In 3 months we are distracted, and again 3 months we are back on track, and again 3 months we are distracted. This is equated to this Shukla Paksha and Krishna Paksha, the waxing and the waning of the moon. With effort, we should ensure that there is only more and more and more of this Shukla Paksha in the mind. So a true yogi can be described as one where slowly the waxing phase of the mind or the Krishna Paksha of the mind is completely removed. So whenever death comes to such a person, the mind is always caught in the Shukla Paksha. And that is the significance of Krishna saying that such a person passes away during the Shukla Paksha. And that is what Swami very beautifully describes in the Gita Vaini. Then comes a mention of the Uttarayana. Probably I'll quickly finish this and then we can conclude. Interestingly, we're speaking about the Uttarayana. Next Thursday is Sankranti, and probably I thought I'll finish this portion, but I'm really running out of time, so we will take this up next time. Maybe it is Swami's design that we speak of the Uttarayana when the Uttarayana starts, because next Thursday, the 14th of January, is the Sankranti day when Uttarayana truly begins. So we'll speak of Uttarayana when Uttarayana begins next week. So I'll conclude this episode here, dear listeners. I most humbly offer this at Swami's lotus feet. I thank you all for your very patient listening. I know this part of the Gita may be a little complex, and I'm trying to fit in a lot of things into the time that is available. And I hope there were some takeaways in what we are learning together as part of the Gita series. I'll meet you all next week at 10 o'clock on that next beautiful Thursday, on that holy day of Sankranti, to resume our journey of the Triune Pilgrimage of the Gita series. Till I meet you next week, take care, keep safe. Jai Sai Ram.